The hardest battle. In late 1992, nearly a year after our blissful ski holiday, our lives took a devastating turn. Sally began showing strange symptoms, first a limp, then a growing unsteadiness in her movements. Soon she struggled with coordination and felt numbness creeping through her limbs. We knew something was wrong, but nothing could have prepared us for the diagnosis: a brainstem tumor. The words landed like a thunderclap. The doctors were blunt. The tumor was deep, dangerous, and likely malignant. Surgery was urgent. But there was a complication. Sally was pregnant with our third child. We were advised in no uncertain terms to terminate the pregnancy. "The baby won't survive the surgery," they warned, "and your wife might not either." But Sally, with a quiet, immovable strength, refused. "I'm having this baby," she said. "Whatever happens to me, happens." And so, against all logic, all odds, and all medical advice, the operation went ahead, with two anesthetists in the theater, one for Sally, one for our unborn child. I sat outside that room with my heart in my throat, not knowing if I would lose one or both. The surgery was delicate and tense. The surgeon did what he could. He couldn't remove the tumor, it was too entangled, but he took a biopsy and managed to stabilize her. A few days later, the results came in. The tumor was malignant. Despite the grim prognosis, Sally survived, and so did the baby. It was a medical miracle, and a testament to her defiance, her unbreakable will. But we were far from safe. As her pregnancy progressed, so did her fatigue, her pain, and the dark cloud of uncertainty. Her body was weak, her spirit flickering. Still, she pressed on, determined to carry our child to term. Then at 6 months, on March 10, 1993, Josh was delivered by cesarean section, 3 months premature, but breathing. I'll never forget the sight of him, tiny, fragile, yet screaming with life. In that moment, we were overwhelmed with a kind of joy only people who have danced with death can know. My mother, who had once disapproved of our marriage, had long since grown to love Sally like a daughter. She stepped in immediately, nurturing Josh while we braced for the next storm. Radiotherapy came next, a brutal ritual disguised as treatment. First, they made a plastic mold of her face, a cold, rigid mask sculpted for precision. When they strapped it on, it hugged her skin so tightly it left no room for breath or movement. Once fitted, she looked like something out of legend, the man in the iron mask, only this was no fiction. This was real. This was war. And yet it was a war we were losing. The beams scorched, but the tumor stood its ground, mocking every effort. The doctors talked of protocols, of next steps, but every door we knocked on only opened to more questions, more uncertainty. We chased hope down every corridor, and every time it slipped through our fingers. The treatments failed, the tumor stayed, and Sally, though fierce in her love, stubborn in her fight, was fading. Then amid the bleakness came something unexpected, a voice from the past, a reconnection that brought with it a strange, fragile comfort. Sally reached out to her estranged father, Ron, the man who had walked away from Barbara when Sally was just 8. He'd been a traveling salesman back then, the kind who lived out of suitcases in roadside cafes. Somewhere along the way, he met another woman, Joyce, and that was the end of Barbara's marriage. Ron left, just left, started a new life, a new business, a lampshade company with Joyce called Gay Lights of Bromley. After that, he disappeared from Sally's world. No letters, no visits, no money. Just absence. A hollow where a father should have been. Years later, when Sally turned 18, she tried to bridge that chasm. She moved to Bromley, Hayes Lane, enrolled in college to study banking, and landed a job at Midland Bank in New Cross. She moved in with her dad and Joyce, determined to rebuild something that had been broken for so long. But soon after, Joyce was diagnosed with cancer and passed away. I had never been to a funeral before, never stepped foot inside a church. My parents were Muslim, but not practicing, and I an atheist. But that day, as the vicar spoke of Jesus, of surrender, of seeking peace in faith, something shifted. I listened, really listened, and oddly I found myself thinking of my own father. He was the one I turned to in every moment of crisis. That, I realized, was its own kind of faith. After Joyce's death, something in Ron shifted. The sharp edges softened. He started visiting more often, sitting down for dinners, trying, awkwardly, to piece together some version of family life. For a while, it felt almost normal. Then came the advert. A lonely heart's plea in the local paper. 60-year-old man, he wasn't, seeks lady friend to share the rest of his life. Ron disappeared again. He met Norma, and slowly, inevitably, the visits dwindled to nothing. But before he disappeared for good, he left us with one final gift, a cruise through the Caribbean booked with Cunard. "You deserve a break," he said. "This might be your last holiday together." I wish I could tell you that trip healed us, that it soothed open wounds, but it wasn't paradise. It became one of the darkest chapters of our lives. We were in Antigua when Brian Lara smashed his way into the history books, scoring a world record 375 runs against England. The ship buzzed with excitement. Half the passengers on the Cunard liner poured off to witness it firsthand. We planned to go too, but getting Sally ready was like pulling a drowning soul back to the surface. By the time we tried to leave, it was too late. The game was already underway, and the chance had slipped through our fingers. So instead of cheering in the stands, I sat in our cabin, watching her fade. Sally's depression clung to her like a second skin, spreading darker with every passing hour. Outside, the island shimmered in the Caribbean sun, and the laughter of holidaymakers floated back to the ship like distant music. Inside, the silence was suffocating. The endless horizon, the vast blue expanse, the relentless performance of joy, it all became a cruel mirror to the emptiness inside her. If she could have stepped off that deck into the sea, I believe she would have. And me? I stood there, powerless. Watching the woman I loved unravel, knowing I had no way, no words, no gesture that could pull her back. When we docked and came home in April, I was running on fumes, until a friend handed me a copy of Reader's Digest. Inside was an article about a pioneering neurosurgeon in New York, Dr. Fred Epstein, world-renowned, a man who specialized in removing exactly the type of tumor that was killing Sally. It felt like a lifeline tossed into stormy seas. We reached out. To my astonishment, Epstein called us personally. His voice carried something we hadn't felt in months. Hope. But hope came with a price. The surgery, the flights, the stay in New York. It was all far beyond anything we could afford. Our UK consultant supported the plan, but the NHS slammed the door. No funding, no help. We were on our own. My only option was to act quickly. Banks, friends, I begged. I raided our company's VAT fund. My brother Alkin gave me everything he had. Martin Potter sold his van and gave me the proceeds. Fred stepped in to keep the business running while I scrambled. I even wrote to Buckingham Palace in desperation, praying for a miracle. Everything we had, everything we were, went into saving Sally. Dr. Fred Epstein, moved by our story and the sheer desperation in our voices, made us an extraordinary offer. He would perform the surgery free of charge. I remember the moment he told us. I was stunned into silence. In a world where so much had been denied, here was a man offering everything. With the support of our friends and family, I managed to scrape together a hefty deposit and an agreement with the NYU Medical Center to pay off all our medical bills after treatment was received. The day came. We flew to New York. The reception was warm, reassuring, and for the first time in a long time, I felt we were in safe hands. The surgery was performed with the precision of a master. When it was over, Dr. Epstein emerged with unexpected news. The tumor was benign. The weight we had carried for so long lifted in an instant. We were stunned, disbelieving. For the first time in what felt like years, we cried tears not of fear, but of fragile, bewildered hope. What we didn't know was that behind the scenes, Sally's case had drawn unexpected attention. Sarah Ferguson's PR team had reached out to NYU Hospital to vet our story, that a British woman had traveled to New York for a pioneering surgery after being failed by the NHS. The hospital, thrilled that royalty, British royalty, had taken notice, ramped up their press outreach. Within days, USA Today ran a feature on Sally's miraculous recovery. The press frenzy that followed was immediate. Back in Lewisham, reporters descended on our quiet street like a swarm. Journalists camped outside our house, eager for a soundbite or a photo. They even interviewed Sally's mother, who had stayed behind to care for our boys, Ben and Ramey. The Daily Express sent a correspondent to the U.S. to track me down. Headlines screamed from newsstands. "Anything Princess Diana can do, Fergie can do better." It wasn't exactly accurate. Fergie's team hadn't orchestrated the operation, but it made for excellent copy, and it brought visibility to Epstein's work and to Sally's journey. 5 weeks after the surgery, Sally and I flew home, and she walked off the plane. She walked. After everything, the prognosis, the pregnancy, the surgery, Sally stepped onto English soil on her own 2 feet. It felt like a rebirth. But the battle wasn't over. She still needed extensive physiotherapy, and we managed to secure her a place at an Army rehabilitation center in Woolwich. We had such high hopes, but reality was a gut punch. The rehab center was grossly understaffed. Promises of intensive therapy turned into short, perfunctory sessions. After several weeks, Sally was discharged, not with renewed strength, but with a diagnosis that broke our hearts. She would never regain full function in her limbs. How could that be? She had walked off the plane. Yet here she was, deteriorating. Frustrated and unwilling to accept this fate, I began scouring the globe for alternatives. That's when I discovered the remarkable story of Valentino Dikul, a Russian trapeze artist who had shattered his spine in a devastating fall. Doctors told him he'd never walk again. But he defied them. Through years of grueling self-designed therapy, he not only walked, he returned to the circus as a strongman. His miraculous recovery led to the founding of a revolutionary rehab center in Moscow, attracting patients from around the world. One such story involved David Hurd, a Brit whose friend had been paralyzed in a horrific car crash. Inspired by Dikul's story, he took his friend to Moscow, and the man walked again. David returned to the UK determined to bring this hope to others. He partnered with physiotherapists from the Russian Center and opened a facility in Stroud called Sportability. I knew immediately this was our next move. But there was one problem. Money. We were tapped out. Every penny had gone toward the American surgery. I couldn't bear the thought of telling Sally that after everything, she might have to resign herself to a wheelchair. But, once again, Martin Potter, our ever-loyal friend from up the creek, came through. He shared our story with Malcolm, the club's owner, and between them they made dozens of calls, pulling every string they could. The result? A benefit night like no other. The stage was packed with stars. Jules Holland, John Thompson, Simon Day, and Glenn Tilbrook from Squeeze, who would later become a dear friend. I even played squash with Glenn once. He was terrible. I teased him that he should use his guitar as a racket since he clearly had more control over that. That evening raised everything we needed. Every Monday, Sally and I would drive to Stroud, check into a modest B&B, and she'd begin her week-long sessions at Sportability. We returned home on Fridays, exhausted but uplifted. The center was extraordinary. It didn't matter what condition someone arrived in, paralysis, MS, degenerative disease, any improvement was considered a victory. Moving a finger, lifting a toe, even sitting unaided for the first time, these were monumental wins. But it wasn't just clinical. Sportability brought joy back into Sally's life. She took part in canoeing, even glider flights, laughing, free again, even if only for a moment. The progress was promising. So promising, in fact, that we began laying plans for an exercise video tailored for the elderly and disabled, inspired by Calinetics, the very method that helped Michael Watson rebuild himself after that harrowing fight with Eubank. It was a glimmer of hope, a reminder that even broken things could heal, given time, patience, and care. And yet, during all this hope, I must now make a shameful confession, one I wish I didn't have to write. Up until this point, I may have come across as strong, steadfast, and devoted. And in many ways, I truly was. I loved Sally deeply. I was loyal in every way that counted, except one. But I was also human, and at times painfully flawed. Looking after Sally had become all-consuming. The loneliness crept in slowly, like damp through an old wall, quiet, steady, and unrelenting. There were no more shared smiles in bed, no intimacy, no touch beyond the functional. I never resented her, not for a second, but I did miss connection. I missed feeling wanted. One day I was granted 24 hours of respite. A well-meaning friend, though perhaps not a wise one, suggested I take the opportunity to clear my head. "Go to Amsterdam," he said. "You need a release." He said it jokingly, but the idea lodged itself in my tired mind, desperate, worn down, and craving something, anything, that made me feel alive again. I drove to Amsterdam alone. I headed straight for the infamous red light district and found myself in a place called the Grasshopper Inn, right in the heart of it all. I ordered a drink and sat in the corner with a book, feigning interest in the words, but really, I was trying to work up the courage. Dutch courage, ironically. buzzed and hollow, I eventually stood and wandered out into the narrow, neon-lit streets. Without giving myself too much time to think, I walked up to the window of a woman who was undeniably beautiful. "How much?" I muttered, my voice low, already weighted with guilt. 50 guilders, she replied in clipped English. "Suck and fuck." I nodded, ashamed at how quickly I agreed. She led me up a spiral staircase, into one room, through another, and finally into a private space with a small bed, a sink, and a roll of disposable paper on the wall. Mechanically, she pulled down the sheet and spread it across the mattress. "Undress," she said. I did as I was told, dazed and already full of self-loathing. Then the alcohol caught up with me. I needed to pee, urgently. "Where's the toilet?" I asked. She gestured vaguely behind us, through the other room, but someone's in there. I shifted uncomfortably. "You can use the sink," she said flatly. Mortified but desperate, I awkwardly tried to aim, but the sink was too high. I was too short. My legs were trembling. In a moment of flawed logic, I climbed onto the edge of the bed and leaned over. That's when it happened. The sink gave way with a bone-splitting crack, ripping violently from the wall like a dislocated joint. It crashed to the floor in 3 jagged pieces, ceramic shattering like brittle bone against the cold tiles. From the exposed pipes, water erupted. Hot, high pressure, furious. It shot out in gouts and spurts, a savage pulse, like blood gushing from a freshly severed artery. Within seconds, the room was soaked, the floor glistening with chaos, and a cold spray misting the air like the aftermath of an accident. I froze. The girl froze. For a heartbeat, we were statues in a war zone. Then came the scream. She shouted something in Dutch, sharp, furious, terrifying, and lurched toward the doorway. I was already gone. Heart hammering, trousers barely done up, I leapt over the fractured porcelain and bolted through the corridor, past startled faces and blinking neon. My footsteps slapped across the flooded floor as I stumbled back into the night. Back on the street, I ducked into an alley and wept. Not just from shame, but from the overwhelming disgust at what I'd done, at whom I had become, even if only for a night, soaked in water, shame, and a kind of self-disgust I had never known before. I had betrayed the woman I loved. I had hurt myself, and I had paid for it, in more ways than one. When the alcohol wore off, I drove home, silent and ashamed. I never told Sally. I couldn't. The guilt was enough to carry for a lifetime. But the self-reproach didn't have long to linger. Because just as I was beginning to breathe again, Sally's mobility started to decline. Slowly at first, barely perceptible, then alarmingly fast. The signs were there in her movement, her balance, the look in her eyes. We returned to see her consultant, Mr. Gullen, who ordered an urgent MRI. The results, when they came, were devastating. Gullen was blunt. The tumor had returned, and there was nothing more he could do. But something didn't sit right. I knew her symptoms. This didn't feel like a tumor recurrence. I asked for the scans, packed them, and FedExed them directly to Dr. Epstein in New York. Within days, he got back to us. His words were clear and terrifying. It wasn't the tumor. A cyst had developed on Sally's brainstem, dangerously close to rupturing, a post-surgical complication that was accelerating fast. Surgery was critical, but travel was out of the question. Flying was suicidal. The change in cabin pressure could cause instant death. Sailing wasn't an option either. The cyst was progressing too quickly. The operation had to be done in the UK, immediately. I turned to Gullen, but he refused. He believed Sally wouldn't survive the procedure. Desperate, I contacted Dr. Epstein again. He was adamant. She needs surgery and soon. If they want my guidance, I'll offer it. Determined, I bypassed Gullen and contacted Professor Henry Thomas at Queen's Neurology Department in central London. After reviewing Sally's case, he agreed to a full evaluation. This second opinion forced Gullen's hand. He finally relented. Sally was admitted to King's College Hospital in Dulwich on Friday, October 13, 1998. Her roommate, none other than General Pinochet of Chile, flanked by armed guards. A strange twist of fate in an already surreal journey. The next day, October 14th, Gullen performed the surgery. Sally was awake the entire time, but in a final blow of arrogance or fear, he refused to follow Epstein's advice. Rather than drain the cyst at its origin in the brainstem, he took an alternate, more conservative route. Instead of following the precise and urgent instructions laid out by Dr. Epstein, accessing the cyst directly at the brainstem and draining it from its source, Mr. Gullin chose a different path. He opted for a more conservative approach, the insertion of a reservoir to redirect the cerebrospinal fluid, threading it down through Sally's frontal ventricle, just above her forehead. The decision felt clinical, even cavalier, as though he were patching a plumbing issue, not navigating the delicate neural web of a young mother clinging to life. In the operating room, Sally was awake, listening to every movement, every instrument, every whispered word. She lay perfectly still as the drill met bone, her mind braced against the fear, trusting in the hands of a man who had already failed her once. And then, something went wrong. She heard the change in tone before she could register what was happening. The muted confidence gave way to quiet tension. Gullin had inserted the reservoir, but it failed to fill. The fluid wasn't moving, the system was blocked, and yet instead of adjusting course or consulting the notes from Epstein's team, they simply closed her up, patched the skull, stitched the scalp. The moment passed, the opportunity was lost. Later, we would learn that Gullin had delayed his holiday by just one day to perform what he considered a necessary procedure. That knowledge still burns how transactional her life must have seemed to him. A detour. A box to tick before a weekend away. By the next day, Sunday, October 15th, Sally was moved from intensive care back to the ward she now shared with General Pinochet, an irony we never quite got over. Armed guards flanked the entrance, a surreal backdrop to the quiet heartbreak unfolding in the bed beside him. She looked at me with tired, searching eyes. There was a weight in them I hadn't seen before. I knew she was trying not to show her disappointment. I held her hand and told her not to worry. I promised her that I'd call Professor Thomas the next morning and insist he take over, this time doing things exactly as Epstein had advised. Then, with her voice barely above a whisper, she asked me to go home. "Check on the boys," she said. They had a swimming gala that evening, and she couldn't stomach another plastic tray of gray hospital food. "Just bring me something warm," she said. "Something from home." I drove back in silence, the weight of that operating room still pressing on my chest. At home, I told Barbara what had happened. I tried to put on a brave face for Ben and Remy, but inside, I was spiraling. I couldn't even bring myself to take them to the gala. Instead, I did the only thing that still made sense. I cooked. Chicken and mushrooms in a white wine sauce, her favorite, with grapes and rice. Comfort on a plate. I packed it carefully, still warm, and drove back through the night to be by her side. When I arrived, Sally sat up in bed. Her face lit up when she saw me, and for a moment it felt like the old days. "This is beautiful," she said as I slowly spooned the meal into her mouth. "You're a better chef than you think." She reached for my hand, holding it tightly. Then, quietly, she began to speak, words that have never left me. She thanked me for everything. From the moment of her diagnosis, to the sleepless nights researching specialists, to the countless flights and fundraisers. She told me she loved me, and that she felt so deeply blessed that we had found one another in this life. She spoke of the boys with such tenderness it shattered me. She cried for Josh, who had never known her as she was before, the vibrant, athletic woman who once danced, ran, cooked for 30 without breaking a sweat. "He's never been in my arms," she whispered. "Not properly." Then came the request that broke me. "Promise me you'll raise them to be strong, to be good, to remember me. Promise you'll guide them into manhood with love." I nodded through the tears. She had one more wish. Of our three sons, she wanted Josh to have her engagement ring, a 5-stone opal that I had given her years ago, a symbol of the life we had built. She hoped he might one day give it to the woman he loved. "The other two will understand," she said. "They knew me, Josh didn't." That evening, we simply lay beside each other, her hand in mine, our heads together. I told her everything was going to be fine, that tomorrow we'd make it right, that she would walk again, that this wasn't the end. But it was. In the deep hours of night, without warning, her body began to convulse. Her skin erupted in hives. She gasped for air, each breath a desperate struggle. I leapt to my feet, shouting for the nurses. "Help her! Please, help her!" The room was chaos. Machines, voices, beeping monitors. But I could feel it. I could feel her slipping. And just before dawn, she squeezed my hand one last time. And then, she was gone. The silence that followed Sally's death was deafening. The world outside carried on, traffic hummed, the sun rose, but everything inside me had gone still. I went home in a daze, as if navigating through fog. There I told Barbara. Then I gathered Ben, Remy, and little Josh and brought them back to the hospital so they could say goodbye. The weight of that walk down the hospital corridor with our sons is something I can never forget. I knelt beside them and said quietly, "Mum loved you more than anything in this world." I wanted to give them something to hold on to, something soft amidst the harshness of it all. Then Josh, just 4 years old, looked up at me with those wide, innocent eyes and asked, "Was it your cooking that killed Mum?" The words hit like a hammer to the chest. So pure. So sincere. There was no accusation in his voice, only childlike logic. He'd heard me say I'd cooked her last meal, but inside me, it cracked something wide open. I grieved in rage. Not at Josh, not at Sally, at the injustice, at the negligence, at the arrogance of a man who had chosen convenience over precision. Gullen's refusal to follow Epstein's protocol, his decision to thread a reservoir through her forehead instead of accessing the cyst at the stem, had cost Sally her life. The air bubble created during the procedure had likely traveled downward when she sat up to eat. It was small, invisible, but lethal. A tiny invader that had stolen everything. But there was no proof, no formal inquest, no medical accountability, just a sterile report, a funeral, a silence. And David. David Glencourse was a familiar face, a friend, a senior anchor at Sky who at the time was with ITN Meridian. When he heard of Sally's death, he didn't offer just condolences. He offered action. He told me, "Her story deserves to be told. This can't be just another name on a hospital list." With his help, ITN ran a feature on Sally's battle. They told the truth. They showed our journey, the fight, the failure, the quiet dignity with which Sally endured it all. They showed the cracks in a system that let patients fall through. And people responded. Letters flooded in from strangers, mothers, fathers, nurses, survivors, widowers, people who'd lost loved ones, people who were fighting their own battles. Some raged with me. Others simply reached out to say, "I see you. I'm sorry." It was humbling, unexpected, and somehow healing. And it was through that broadcast that someone else re-entered my life. Andrew, a regular from Pistachios, a man I hadn't seen in years. He reached out gently, asking if we could meet for a coffee. Nothing formal, no pressure, just one human to another, reaching across the void. It was a small gesture, but it would go on to shape the next chapter of my life. Because sometimes, the smallest hand offered in grief can be the very thing that pulls you from the edge. And in the wake of Sally's death, as I looked at our sons and wondered how to carry on, I clung to every gesture that offered light. This was not the end. It was the beginning of something else. Something built not from ambition or business, but from memory, love, and a promise I made to a woman who once danced in my arms and whispered, "Raise them well." And I intended to.